Good evening. My name is Mary, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Mary.
You almost had me crying there. Because Bill was a very important part of my early sobriety. I was so rum-dum when I got here that I used to sit in awe of Bill. He was one of my idols. And I thought, my God, he knows more than there is to know. I first would like to thank Jim and the committee here for this privilege, and all of you for the wonderful hospitality you have shown me. I consider it a great privilege to be here. Before I left Southern California, I was talking about this trip, and one of the fellows there in the clubhouse said, "My God, are you going all the way down there to give the message?" And I said, "Hell, I've been farther than that for ice." You know, it still is a wonder and a great miracle to me that I could be standing here talking and people listening to me, because 7 years ago, no one was listening to me, a little over 7 years ago. No one was talking to me. And here I'm standing talking, and, you know, 7 years ago, my life was over. It was all over. In fact, I was trying to commit suicide. I was trying to end it all when it hadn't even started. I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous to get sober. And as far as the third tradition is concerned, I ignore it. Because when I got here, I wasn't alcoholic. I'll have to describe how I fell into this place, though. I had been inhabiting a dirty moo-moo for I don't know how long. I came in here unwashed and 180 pounds of gray bloat, all of it sick, and screaming and homicidally and suicidally insane. But I wasn't alcoholic. It was that guy I was married to. I had been on the wagon so many times that I had proved beyond doubt to me that alcohol was not my problem. It was them out there. And yet when I look back, I was wired for this before I took my first drink. I was alcoholically inclined from the time of my childhood, because I had all of the ingredients that go into making up an alcoholic like me. From the time I can remember, I was always self-centered and willful and hypersensitive. And speaking of sensitivities, it occurred to me recently that though I went around all my life telling people how sensitive I was to pain, it never occurred to me, or perhaps I didn't have the courage or the honesty, to also say that I was sensitive to beauty, the beauty that I have found in this life on AA. I had all the ingredients, and so I took my first drink. I used to be a dancer. This was 30 years and 30 pounds ago. I was on a road show, and I took my first drink when I was about 15 years old, and it was slow gin. And I immediately liked it. I drank alcoholically. I drank as much as I could, threw up, and passed out, and I thought that was part of the deal. But most of all, I liked what it did for me, because it took the knot out of here, and it turned all the lights on up here, and I felt that I belonged. I felt that I fitted in for the first time in my life, and I established communication with the outside world, it seemed to me. And so alcohol or drinking was not my problem, it was my answer. Only proving that there must have been a problem there to begin with, because if there weren't, I wouldn't need an answer. I never did drink socially, and I don't particularly care to. In fact, I'm totally against it. Despite what Chapter 3 says, that it is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker that somehow, someday, he will return to normal drinking. How can you go back to where you've never been? This was all brought into focus to me. I'm the only alcoholic in my family. And a couple of years ago, my brother, who is a non-alcoholic and married to a non-alcoholic, invited me and an AA friend over to their home on Christmas, and they had a few friends of their own over there, and they were doing that thing called social drinking. Now, if there's anyone here who is new or maybe a dropout returning or is not fully convinced that they really are a real alcoholic, perhaps if you follow me emotionally through this scene that occurred, you can make up your own mind about this. I got over to my brother's house, and the first person I met there was a little old lady, and she had one of those tall, anemic drinks, you know, with ice and mix and all that jazz in it, and she was sipping this drink, and she was tiddly, you know. I wanted to belt her in the mouth, because I could see that the ice was melting, you know, And she had a son there that was trying to be drunker than he was, you know, one of those, with a lampshade and all that, you know. Just, it was agonizing. And my friend and I both were getting very uncomfortable. In fact, I know you won't believe this, but I saw a fella put his drink down on the coffee table and go into the next room and leave that drink there unattended for about 10 minutes. Can you imagine that? My hands sweat when I even think of it, you know. Because it took about 6 months to straighten my claw out after I got to AA, because I was like this all the time. That's why I had to give up bathing, incidentally. I remember one afternoon I came to in the tub, and my nose was about an inch from the water, and I figured right away that that bathing was too dangerous a thing for me to pursue. And I was telling this to a woman not long ago, and she said, well, I always took a shower. And without even thinking, I said, what, and get water in the drink? This is after I've been sober, you know. So, anyway, meanwhile, back at the party, my friend and I were getting very, this is agonizing to watch that kind of carrying on. And we coasted into the kitchen where my sister-in-law was cooking. And there was a supply on the table. Now, there must have been about five people drinking, five or six people, and there was a pint on the table with the lid on it, you know. And right next to the pint, and this is embarrassing for me to say this because it happened at a relative's house. Right next to the pint, there was a jigger. Are you ready for that? Yeah. You know, I was walking around with my fists clenched like this, and I would have given my soul if somebody had come into that kitchen and upended the bottle just to give me some relief in here, you know. But my sister-in-law really put the frosting on the cake when my brother came in. He said, Connie, would you like to have another drink? And you know what she said? She said, no, thanks, I'm beginning to feel mine. How does that grab you? Well, you know, the book says science may one day accomplish this. Forget it, you know, forget it. I'm not interested. I keep trying to tell these psychiatrists that, but they have a closed mind. No, I don't know anything about it, social drinking, and I don't really care to. I traveled on this road show, and every time I drank, I overshot the field. I never really intended to get as drunk as I always managed to. Because, you know, I've always been of the opinion since I was a child and up to and including today that anything worth doing is worth doing to excess. That's the thing that I can't get out of my mind. But I wound up finally in the nightclubs of San Francisco, which was really, for a person like me, utopia. See, I had the spotlight on me at all times, and I had beautiful clothes, and I had a nice pad to live in, and I had all the attention of all the men, and I was table hopping every night, giving everybody a break, you know. And I had no responsibilities, really, except to do these two shows a night. And I was written up in all the columns all the time. In fact, I was known as the Belle of Bush Street in San Francisco. And I'd really had everything going for me to the outside world. But to me, there always seemed to be a gnawing hunger for something. And my answer was always when I got him, or when I went there, or when I got that. It was always not now, but in the future, when. And I would get that and him and go there by manipulating and maneuvering, and I always came up empty. And so it was always this search, this hunger that I had inside, and I didn't know what it was. I was laughing on the outside all the time. I was the playgirl. At this particular time, I felt that when Hollywood discovered me, then everything would be all right. So my alcoholic thinking was already there. Change conditions and things, and then everything will be all right. And came the day I was offered a screen test in Hollywood, and I went down there with the attitude that Betty Davis had better start saving her money. Really. And I got down there, and I took the screen test, and it was rotten. How can you act when you're already acting? See, I didn't know those things. So they did sign me to a stock contract. Now, a stock contract is really nothing, you know. You're part of the herd. And I felt, you know, this is a pretty big drop from being the Belle of Bush Street down to a stock contract where nobody's really paying any attention to you. You're just part of the mob. But I still clung to this big hope of setting the world on fire. And I thought that any day one of these enterprising, brilliant producers would discover me, and then everything would be all right. And, of course, this didn't happen. In the meantime, I got caught up in the drinking crowd where they really knew how to live, you know, and Sunset and all those places with the drinking crowd. And I really didn't like this being under a stock contract. And, of course, I didn't rebel against it outwardly, but inwardly I kept thinking, well, any day now. But I could see that my goal was going farther and farther, and I began to lose ambition along those lines. When I was saved from this terrible fate by a man who came to me from the USO office, and the World War was on, World War II was on at the time. And he asked me if I would like to go overseas and entertain the soldiers, and of course, the first thing that came to my mind was all those men over there and all the attention I was going to get. So I immediately accepted, and I went overseas. And in case there's any of you fellows out there who still harbor a small resentment about USO girls not fraternizing with the enlisted men, maybe I can remove some of that resentment, because I was very democratic with my drinking. I drank with Yardbirds, Generals. It didn't make any difference. I didn't say what, I just said where, and let's go. I remember now, I'm talking about like 23 years ago, before I had a problem, but it's still, it's strange that I found it necessary to defend my right to drink, because I remember coming to high in the hills of the Himalaya Mountains in China one morning after I'd been drinking grapefruit juice and something with the fellas the night before. And I was paralyzed. I couldn't move, except my eyelids. They were the only things that were moving. And my roommate noticed my plight, and she ran immediately and got the medics. And they came in there, and they gave me oxygen and shots and coffee and I don't know what all, but they worked on me for 2 solid hours just to get me up on my feet and functioning again. And you know, I blamed the altitude. I had myself so sold that on the fact that I couldn't drink in the altitudes that I didn't even drink in Denver after that. That's how well I had myself sold. Incidentally, this gal who was my roommate was a very big movie star. She had money, property, and prestige. And she died of alcoholism last January. And when these things happen, I say, how come not me? But that's the way it is. She had called me on a Tuesday, not for help, but to tell me that she didn't feel AA could help her because her case was different. They told me when I came in here that when I said my case was different, they said, if your case is different, you're ready. So I came back from that tour feeling very put upon because here they didn't tell me that I was expected to go out and drink with all these fellows and carry on. And I came home exhausted, and I thought, well, they didn't tell me all this, but now I had this offer to go to the European Theater, and I thought, well, this time it's going to be different. Just like Chapter 3 says, that's the story of my life. This time I'm not going to be the playgirl, and this time I'm not going to do all that drinking, and I'm going to take care of things and watch my behavior and my conduct, because I always had a behavior problem long before I drank. And so I sailed over to Europe thinking this time it'll be different, and it was. It was worse. Because I didn't know how not to get caught up in the same thing again. And for me, Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me how not to do things, which is just as important as how to do things. But I got caught up in the same thing again. But now my drinking and my behavior was getting progressively worse because my attitudes were getting worse. I was getting hostile, and I was getting mean, and I was getting bad to be around. In fact, you're probably looking at the only USO girl that was up for court-martial. And I'll have to tell you about that. I was always madly in love or recovering from love. I don't know which I enjoyed the most, really. You know, when you're recovering, you can play all those sad songs, you know, like The Man That Got Away, Judy Garland. I liked her in particular because with her there's no hope, you know. Sit there and listen to that music and cry, you know. I used to love that. But at this particular time, I was in love with some lieutenant that I had met several towns back, and I was involved in this this party that was going on. And I remember trying to reach this lieutenant back here, the great love of my life, by field telephone. And for you ladies who don't know what that is, you have to go through relays. And sometimes it takes quite a while to reach whoever you want, like 10 or 15 minutes. And I was busily trying to get in touch with this guy while this party was going on around me. And I remember this captain who was pretty loaded, leaning over me, begging me to go drink or play with him or whatever. And I very dramatically told him that I was, you know, trying to reach this fellow back there. And he made a big mistake. He took his thumb and disconnected the phone. And this angered me. And I told him that if he did that once more, I was going to hit him. And you know that guy didn't believe me. So he did it again, and I hit him. And I hit him as hard as I could, not really meaning to, on the ear. And he was so loaded that he didn't realize what happened for a few minutes until he saw that look on my face. And that look on my face came from seeing the blood gush out of his ear and down his white trench coat. And so when he saw that, he screamed like a banshee and ran across the street to where the MPs were hostled and signed all these papers and everything. And the next morning, he couldn't identify me. And I always like to tell that story because I'm like the big director in the book. You know, I got the whole scene all planned, and I guess I might as well tell you, you already know what the scene is. I'm hoping that this fellow, looking back, I'm pretty sure he was an alcoholic. And I'm hoping, of course, that he somehow found his way to AA. And I got it all planned in my head that some night, maybe even tonight, some night I'll be talking up here and relating this story. And after the meeting, this captain is going to come forward with his hand extended and say, Mary, I'm that captain you hit on the ear. And you know I'm going to let him make his amends to me. Does that make you feel good? Yeah, I mean that, though, because one of the beautiful gifts I got from this program is the fact that, you know, we weren't always wrong. You know, even a clock that stopped is right twice a day. And this behavior of mine and my attitude was getting progressively worse, and at that time I thought the only place for me is back in San Francisco, where I had all that fun, where people are people. And the first thing that happened to me when I got back to the shores of the United States, I headed straight for San Francisco, where I had all that fun. How much fun can you endure? I got back there, and everything there seemed to have changed. Everything had like a gray cast to it. And I blamed at that time the terrible things I had seen during the war overseas. That was the reason for my attitude, and people over here really didn't understand. Of course, that's like a thread that wove through my whole life anyway. They don't understand, or you don't understand. And so I tried to drink up this hilarity that I used to call happiness, and I used to try to manufacture it, and I did everything in my power to pull it back, but I had already drunk away my right to a chemical peace of mind, and I didn't know it. But I pursued it and pursued it, and it just wouldn't happen anymore. And so I thought, well, I'm over the hill now. I'm 25 years old, and maybe it's time for me to get married and settle down and all that. And so I looked around and carefully selected a victim. It happened to be a bartender that I couldn't stand. And I asked him to marry me. Now, he didn't even drink, which should have been my first clue. Because I don't trust people that don't drink. I mean, you know, the normal people. But you know, the women of Al-Anon have come to know that every pot goes out and finds a lid that fits it, right? So I happened to pick a compulsive gambler. Now, I'll give you a little insight into this marriage. Well, it wasn't really a marriage. It was more like a suicide pact. Because, see, he was gambling my drinking money, and I was drinking his gambling money. It's funny now, but it wasn't then. And, you know, I remember our wedding night. We got married in Reno. That was the scene of the accident. And I remember our wedding night. I spent in bed passed out, and he spent the night down at the 21 table, you know. But I wasn't looking for clues in those days, you know. But anyway, I remember standing in front of the Justice of the Peace, saying my vows, and thinking, what am I doing here? Tomorrow or the next day, I'll get an annulment. Because I knew it was no good inside here. But I didn't have those ingredients that it requires to terminate or not go through a thing. I didn't have, for instance, any honesty at all. I had what I thought was honesty, but my honesty can best be described by telling a story about a fellow who was going into the confessional. And on the way, Father Fred's going to steal this one. On the way in, this fellow stole the priest's watch. So he was confessing his sins, and finally he said, and by the way, Father, I stole a man's watch. And the priest said, you must return it. And he said, well, here, Father, you take it. And the priest said, I don't want it. And then the fellow said, well, Father, the fellow that I stole it from doesn't want it back. And the priest said, well, keep it. That's the kind of honesty I had. So we got back to San Francisco, and I couldn't tell everybody at that big reception that they surprised us with that I was either drunk or was kidding. And so you know what I had to do. Half measures avail us nothing, you know. I had to prove this to be the marriage of the century. And so we immediately took a geographic for each other. And as soon as we got down to Los Angeles, I found new drinking buddies right across the street, and he found new bookies right up on the corner. And the race was on again. And I knew that this chaotic thing was deteriorating by the day, and finally I thought to myself, well, now maybe if I have a baby, you know, change conditions and things. And I got pregnant, and now with this pregnancy, I decided I was going to be a completely different person. This woman that I was going to be was Better Homes and Gardens' idea of a perfect wife, mother, housekeeper, the whole shot. And I knew that I was going to do everything by the numbers, you know. I was going to do the lawn on Sundays, the laundry on Mondays, and I was going to wear pink curlers to the market like they did and do all the things that they did. And I knew most of all that this woman that I now was going to be did not drink. And so I went on the wagon. That chokes me up when I use that expression. And, of course, going on the wagon, this compulsion of mine had to come out someplace, and I became a compulsive housekeeper. You know, I used to clean the corners with pins. And I had a Q-tip that I got the little droplets of water with. And I had a toothbrush that I cleaned the letters on the appliances with. And if the old man got out of bed in the middle of the night to go to the John, his bed was made before he got back. You know, that's a pretty tense way to live, I'll tell you. I know there are others of you out there like that, too, because I was talking in San Francisco not long ago, and this gal came up to me, and she was laughing, and she identified right down the line. She said, but I did one thing that you didn't do, if you think that was far out. She said, I used to blow the dust out of the keyholes. And if any of you out there have done any of those things, please tell me, because, you know, this makes me feel like, you know, part of the whole thing. It doesn't make me feel so foreign out there. But I pursued this thing, you know, and I was determined to be this woman, and it was just miserable, walking around with clenched fists and gritted teeth and determined that I was going to be this woman, and it was just a miserable existence, not only for me, but for everybody around me. And so when the baby was born, you know, it's a wonder I didn't boil him, because by that time I was boiling everything. As such was my fear, you know, I thought the world was going to contaminate this child. And so this went along for a little while until I discovered that I was pregnant with a second child. Now, I hadn't planned that one. And, you know, my attitudes when I was drinking was either I'll show him or what's the use. And here it was. What's the use? Here I have the first child's whole life planned out. I know what schools he's going to attend. And I know what he's going to be. And all these things. And here comes this intruder. And so I resented him, you know, right away. And, of course, with these attitudes, I had to start drinking again. I must add, much to the relief of my family and friends. Because they like me drunk better than crazy. And, in fact, I did, too. But I didn't know anything about alcoholism, nor the progression, and it wasn't very long before the progression of the disease caught up with me, and I was out there drinking, stumbling around, just as I was before I stopped drinking. And, of course, I was justified in this, because here I was stuck clear out in the country, pregnant and barefoot all the time. And I'd heard this expression, and it was happening to me, and I couldn't stand it. And I couldn't stand this fellow that I was married to. It was all his fault. And I really, in my own mind, felt justified in this. And so I was drunk most of the time. I was pregnant with my second child. And I don't say that with any pride, nor do I have to be ashamed of it anymore, because I had to do what I had to do, and I had to live the way I lived, and I broke my own heart. Used to reel through the neighborhood there and look at the eyes of my neighbor women and see that look. You know what that look is. We know what it is. It's a mixture of contempt and pity and bewilderment. And yet I still had that cloak of arrogance about me that made me say to them silently, but you don't understand, and you never will. But things got so bad that ultimately I felt it necessary to explain to some of the neighbor women why I had to drink and what a rotten guy I was married to and how rough he made life for me and the child and everything. And I never forget one of the women, she took all this in, and she looked to me and she said, you know, if I was married to a guy like that, I'd be drinking too. You know what she did. I already had the reason. All she did is give me permission. And so I pursued this thing, and after the second child was born, my husband left me because he took a dim view of my activities. And my activities consisted of going up to the neighborhood bar and drinking with the men up there, because that's the only place I felt comfortable or understood or needed or wanted. And he left, and now I was free to go around and do what I wanted to do, and I was rid of him. And I resented both of my children, and I didn't neglect them. I abandoned them every opportunity that I had, because the only thing that was important to me was the alcohol, where I was going to get my next drink, and when, and with whom, That wasn't too important either. But the only place I really felt comfortable was drinking with the woman across the street or up at the neighborhood bar, preferably, with the fellows who really understood me, because I hated women. I really hated them with a passion. And so we went back and forth, my husband and I. We went back together for the sake of the children, and then separated and back together and separated. And as a result of one of these joyous reunions, I got pregnant the third time. And now I was outraged womanhood, you know. Now this was it. I just, my rage knew no limits. I resented him so much that this hatred inside of me couldn't even be diminished by drinking. I couldn't even knock myself out. By the way, along the way, I took up the habit of taking tranquilizers, sedatives, barbiturates. But what difference does it make what kind of shoes you got on as long as you're running? I just didn't want to be what I was, where I was. And all these things were merely a method of transportation for me for a long time. I was drunk all the time I was carrying my third child, and I didn't care. And I didn't care about me, and I didn't care about anyone else, because I couldn't care. To me, everything was hopeless and useless and black and desolate. And I was justified, and they didn't understand. Nobody understood me. And so after the third child was born, my husband left for what turned out to be the last time. And now I was really free to go up and drink when I wanted to. But really, in my own mind, I felt that if I really got rid of this guy, I wouldn't have to drink the way I do. I could cut down and wouldn't have to suffer these terrible agonies, which made it necessary for me to drink the way I did, because I truly didn't think I was an alcoholic. And it's a strange thing. Coming home one morning from my usual daily run with a bottle in the sack and either a stalk of celery or a loaf of bread so that the neighbors wouldn't know, you know, the camouflage, I thought to myself, why is it then, now that he's gone, that I am still making these daily runs up to the market for my fifth of, or quart preferably, of bourbon or vodka? Why is it that I'm still doing this? And I shut my head off right away because I didn't want to know. And I pursued this. And now, things began to happen to me that I never thought would ever happen. All the things that happen to an alcoholic woman, all the humiliations, all the degradations, all the self-loathing, started to happen to me in rapid succession. I was thrown out of bars where I was once welcome. I remember how it felt to lurch down one of the main boulevards there in broad daylight, hitting the sides of buildings and biting back the tears of this terrible hatred I had for myself, or this terrible shame that I felt, lurching and reeling and trying to walk straight. I remember how it felt to wake up in an alley one cold gray dawn, feeling cold and shaking and scared and wondering what had become of the great Belle of Bush Street, and feeling like I had been thrown on a scrap heap of life, and as indeed I had. And these are the things that kept happening, these and many more things, and these are the things that led me to drink behind closed doors and drawn shades. Now, all this time, my children are running around loose in the neighborhood, and thank God the neighbors took care of them, thank God, because I was not able to care about them or me or anything. I was drinking with this terrible homicidal hatred I had for this man, because it was he that had ruined my whole life, my whole future, and there was no meaning to anything anymore. And nobody really understood. And I knew that though we were getting a divorce, that he would be hanging over me like a shadow for the rest of my life because I had the children. And this is the idea that I absolutely could not tolerate. And I knew I was going to have to kill him. I knew I was going to do this because 2 or 3 weeks prior to the time I'm speaking of now, I had held him at bay with a 10-inch chef's knife and dared him to move. And I watched that man stand there and turn ashen gray and the perspiration come down his face, not daring to move, because I knew that he was looking at an insane woman, and he knew it. And I wasn't even drunk at the time. I was totally and hopelessly insane at the time. And here I was again plotting how this time he wasn't going to get away. He wasn't going to. I just couldn't stand it. The rage within me was too much to contain. And so here I was, and this thing happened that happens to so many of us, this feeling that I desperately needed help. And the only place I knew where to get help was a policeman, Irish friend of mine, that I used to drink with, and I called him and begged him to lock me up. By now, in the terminal stages of my drinking, I was crying and screaming all the time, and I have not too much recollection except for the terrible rage I felt inside of me and the terrible insanity that I felt, because now I had drunk myself to the point where I couldn't wipe my head out the way I wanted to. The pills were not affecting me, and it was as though my body was drunk and my head was sober, and I couldn't stand it. I absolutely couldn't stand it. I couldn't pass out. I couldn't do anything. And this man came over, and I was ranting and raving at him and pleading with him to lock me up. And he got up and shook his head and said he couldn't do anything because I hadn't committed any crime yet. And as he left, I said, "Kelly, where are you going?" And he said, "I'm going to church to pray for you." I can't describe the dimensions of my desolation at that moment, because I had left God and church and everything far behind me many years prior to this. And again, this thing inside of me wanted to scream out, "But you don't understand." It was the same feeling I had when I fell off a bar stool and I looked up to that sea of faces, and the thing came up and said, "But you don't understand." It was the same thing, but this was a more desperate one. But strangely, I believe that once we sincerely ask for help, that it's on its way. Because the next thing I remember, and I have a very emotional spot right here, I remember babbling to an Episcopal priest that lived a few blocks away from me. And I was crying and screaming. And he asked me to come in and pray. And I told him, "Father, I don't believe in God or prayer or anything else. Just stop me from what I'm about to do." And he somehow convinced me that I should go in and listen to him pray. And I remember, in my insanity, listening to this good man pray for me and thinking, if there is a God, then this thing that is consuming me will be removed by the time I get home. And the reason I'm near tears right now is because after 2 years of sobriety, it turned out that this dear priest had a problem, and his wife called me and asked me to send some help, and I sent a Catholic alcoholic priest in our neighborhood and another fellow over there, and they took him to a couple of meetings. And he was a wonderful, intelligent, marvelous man. And unfortunately, he didn't agree with our theology. And he lost his wife and his home and his parish and everything and disappeared. I don't know where he is. But as is often happens in AA, I am now praying for a man that once prayed for me. I hope someday he'll make it. But I did get home, and this thing had not been removed from me, and the panic was on, and the insanity was full-blown. And the next thing I remember was talking to a fellow from the North Hollywood Clubhouse. And I always remember my total commitment to Alcoholics Anonymous when I talk of this man, because he must have sensed my desperateness. He broke all the rules by coming over right away, a man calling on an alcoholic woman. Thank God. Thank God he came, and he was exactly the right person for me. I don't believe I was ready for a couple of well-groomed, clean, spiritual women to call on me at that time. This fellow was exactly, he was a young fellow, and the important part of the whole thing is that as soon as he walked in, he gave me my first shred of hope. My first shred of hope, because I didn't know what Alcoholics Anonymous was about or anything. And there was an immediate communication between us. And, you know, around here they say, we don't tell you you're alcoholic. You have to find that out for yourself. He told me I was, thank God. He didn't say you got to make up your own mind, because he knew I didn't have a mind to make up at the time. And yet this man was given that the patience. And I guess the right words. I don't know what it was. I don't remember what he said. But it wasn't even important. It was what he was. It was what he was that got through to me. And he got me to my first AA meeting that night, a little over 7 years ago. He had to walk me up and down the highway a few times because I was terrified. And it took me years on AA to even admit that I was born scared. Because I've always been big, brave, and strong, you know. And even when he got me up to the door, he had to push me through. Push me through to my first meeting. And I think the thought came to me as I went through the door, go ahead, Mary, what else can happen that hasn't already happened? That's the feeling I had. And this man turned me over to the woman who was to become my sponsor. And, oh, God, how I've learned to love the women of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon. And, you know, from where I came to here, it's not possible to get here, but here I am. This woman, she represented everything I hated in women. She was well-groomed and soft-spoken and spiritual and clean. And she took me by the hand and led me through impossible places. And this woman, and thank God, it was a small group, and there was a nucleus of about four or five men there who were those old-timers. You know, I really love these old-timers. I guess mostly because I want to be one. But they've got things sifted down in such simple terms. For instance, about 2 weeks ago at one of the participation meetings, you know, everybody that got up and participated was talking to the newcomer, and they were all telling them how to make this program. And one old-timer got up in his old lackadaisical way, simple, and he said, I don't know about the rest of them, but he said, I'll tell you newcomer something. When all else fails, keep drinking. And, you know, they told me to keep it simple, but, not that simple. But these four or five fellows there, they were the type, thank God they didn't treat me with kid gloves or they'd have killed me. I was too insane to be treated, you know, with kid gloves. Sobriety was actually forced on me by my sponsor, who looked me dead in the eye and said, our relationship has to be based on strict honesty. And if I hadn't surrendered up to that point, that was the moment right there. Because I thought, the game's all over. It's all over. And I didn't even know what a liar I was until she said that to me. And these fellows kept dragging me around by the neck and insulting me and calling me all kinds of names and telling me how stupid I was. And it really wounded me, all these people. But I have come to know that the people who hurt me the most were the ones who helped me the most. Because they cared enough to tell me the truth. They cared when I was not able to care for myself. Sobriety was forced on me. I remember what a shock came over me when this woman told me. Now, I was so rummy, the first meeting, I can hardly remember it. But I did remember three things that helped me stay sober, or kept me sober for the first 6 months at least. She said I had to stay away from the first drink at all costs, that I had to find a power greater than myself, and above all, I had to stop fighting anything and anybody. And, you know, I had to pretend all these things because I didn't believe they applied to me at all. You know, they were against my intellect and against my better judgment, and so I faked it. And this is what I had to do all along the first year. I faked everything because I really had nothing to go on. And came the second blow. When she said, she didn't say, would you like to go to a meeting tomorrow night? She said, I'll pick you up at 8 o'clock, and I want you bathed with makeup on and your hair combed and all this. And she said, we're going to a woman's stag. I thought, what are they going to call upon me to do next? Go to a woman's stag, for God's sake. And, you know, it took me about 8 hours that day to bathe and get clean clothes on. I was shaking so violently. I was too afraid to tell anybody that I had been on pills. And something was mentioned about pills that night. And I went through the withdrawal of the alcohol and the pills cold turkey because I was too afraid to tell anybody that I was that sick because I thought they were going to throw me out. And plus the fact that I knew that when I went to the women's stag, if anybody ever found out where I had been and what I had done, they were really going to throw me out. But I have come to know that anything that anybody has done here has been done in spades, and probably by me. But I went to this woman's stag, and I had to pretend that I liked all of them and everything. And I went to 10 meetings a week, and it was not easy for me to sober up, because in the meantime, my husband had heard that I had joined AA, and he took to calling me about 8 times a day just to rattle me and get me all upset, and told me he was going to take the children away from me. He told me he was going to kill me in his own sickness, and he was very distraught. And this kept me right on edge all the time. And I was trying so desperately hard not to drink. And I was fool enough to have still a half a bottle of vodka in my house, because, you know, we can't pour that half a bottle down. I don't know about you, but I couldn't. I had to save it for friends that might drop by, which was a very dangerous thing, especially in my position. That was a very foolish thing, but that was the way I had to do it. And he kept calling me and upsetting me so fiercely that, thank God, this sponsor of mine would answer the phone any time of the day or night. And I called her, and I was ready, not really to drink, but to kill myself, because I couldn't stand this kind of emotional blackmail that I was going through. And I said, "Rita, what am I going to do? He's going to drive me right out of my mind." And, you know, she's an old-timer. You know what she said? She said, "Hang up." It never occurred to me. It just never occurred to me, because, you know, the only way I knew how to live was to get even or lash out or, you know, fight back or threaten back or all these things. And she said simply, "Hang up." Well, I thought, but you don't understand, you know. I didn't say that to her, but I inside again, "But you don't understand. This is different. You really don't understand my case." But I think that's the hardest thing I've ever had to do since I've been on Alcoholics Anonymous. And he used to call. And each time he'd call, I would say, "You are upsetting my serenity," and hang up. You know, very spiritual. You know, I was faking it, but I was trying. Because they told me that the three most important words on AA is "make the effort." Now, in the meantime, I continued to go to these 10 meetings a week. And I started to identify through listening to people talk about their emotions and their attitudes. And I was soaking it up like a sponge. I was too rum-dum to know what the steps were about. I couldn't even read the book for 6 months. I didn't know. All I knew that was this feeling that somebody really did understand and somebody really was like me. And it was a whole new world. And I just took to it like duck takes to water. And I immediately launched out on that crusade. You know, most of us do. And I was out there, you know, healing them all, laying the hands on and telling them to rise and walk again like Lazarus. You know, it was fabulous. It really was. And my sponsor let me, too. And, you know, I didn't help anybody. Sure helped me. It kept me sober. But in the meantime, I wasn't fighting this fellow, and I was going to all these meetings, and I was picking up on some of these things were making sense to me. And everything was going so beautifully. I couldn't believe it. I really couldn't believe it. Then I was about 3 months sober, and he must have had a bad day at the track or something. But he called me, and again, in this terrible, threatening voice, he was going to kill me and the children and all this stuff. And I immediately this homicidal rage rose up in me, and I almost just went completely out of it. I almost fell apart. I really did, and I didn't know what to do. And thank God it was the night of the woman's stag. Because I went in there screaming at the top of my voice that night. I said, I'm going to flip right out of it. I'm going to kill this guy. Though I haven't had a drink or a pill or anything else, I have to kill him. And I said, "Please, what am I going to do?" And I'll never forget the advice that I got from one of those women that has been my theme song ever since. She said, "Pray for the son of a bitch." And, you know, that was the wisest phrase she could have used, because up until that moment, I didn't know that you could pray for somebody you hated. I didn't know it. And by using that phrase, she let me give myself permission to pray for somebody I hated. and I've used it many times since. This is my theme song. It worked. Because I, you know, at the end of the meeting that night, we were saying the Lord's Prayer, and I was praying for him. I didn't mean a damn word of it. Not a word. But, again, I was making the effort. And pretty soon this started to work, too, and we started becoming good friends because I wasn't fighting and I was doing all those things that those people were telling me. Didn't believe they're going to work for me, though, because my case was different. And I kept doing these things because, really, I had no choice. You know, when you have no choice, it's easy. And I kept doing all these things, and we formed a relationship that was better than it ever had been during our married life or before. And we were able to sit down and talk like two human beings about the future of the children and all these things. We weren't going to go back together, I don't think. I think we both realized that that this was a bad situation. And then one of my big brothers came to me and he said, "Don't you think it's about time you made amends to this fellow? Because, you know, living with me was no trip through Disneyland, I can assure you that." And I said, "Well, if you say so, you know." And he said, "I say so." So, you know, I can't express any kind of gratitude by words because I was privileged to make my amends to him just 2 weeks before he died of a heart attack. And I don't know what would have happened to me if he had died when I hated him so much. But I was freely given this gift by the people of Alcoholics Anonymous. And at the time, I was showered by more spiritual gifts than I have ever known in my life. Because I got a feeling of calm acceptance when the news was given to me over the telephone. A feeling of calm acceptance that I had never experienced before in my life. And I was given the words to tell the children. And for the first time in my life, I knew the feeling of dignity when I needed it the most. But the thing that I will never forget as long as I live was the fact that here I was sober 5 months, and I knew a few people in Alcoholics Anonymous, yet it seemed to me that literally hundreds of people called me, came over, offered of themselves their money, their time, their transportation, whatever I needed or wanted. And I was overwhelmed and sustained. It was fantastic. The ensuing 4.5 years were difficult for me because I had to grow up or start to learn to grow up in a great hurry. I went through more emotional pain than I had ever allowed myself to before. I had to let go and let go absolutely of many things that I thought were important to me. And I had to learn to live within a very limited income. And I had to learn to do a lot of things that really were against my nature. And yet, these people, you know, as I said before, they cared enough about me when I couldn't care enough about myself. And they literally carried me. I don't take any credit for my sobriety because it was all done for me. My very survival was given to me by the people of Alcoholics Anonymous. After 4.5 years, as I told you before, we had many idols. I did. And gurus and teachers. And I used to stand in awe of them. And one of these fellows that was one of my teachers with 20 years sobriety sent one of his emissaries over and asked if he could court me. I'd never been approached like that before. I don't know. I guess I felt ready for it because here I had, I had turned the restaurant into an AA clubhouse, and I had this image built of myself, of the great healer of the West Valley. And anybody that Chuck C. couldn't cure, I could, you know. And I was the big mother of the West Valley, and I felt, you know, I was ready. Now God was opening a new chapter in my life, and so we had a marvelous big AA wedding. At a church out there. There were 300 drunks there. All of them sober, of course. And I'd like to say this, because of Alcoholics Anonymous, we joined hands and walked happily into the sunset and lived happily ever after. And, you know, I always edited my dreams. But that isn't the way it was. You know, I think all marriages are happy. It's learning how to live together afterwards that's a bitch. And, you know, really, I think the thing was that his image married my image. And, of course, I had to learn what I had to learn. And any of you people out there who are sniveling about, gee, this program's awful hard because I'm all alone and if I was married, it'd be different. If you think it's tough single, try it married sometime. But I learned the lessons I had to learn. And I did what I had to do again. And it was a marvelous experience because through this, I came to the realization that I had to seek help from, because my original sponsor had left town when I was a year sober. And I finally had to go to one of the older, fabulous women on this program and ask her to please listen to my inventory because I had been spilling this inventory, his, out at quite a few of the meetings, and I was able to sell a lot of people on my own justifications, but I couldn't sell me, and I was in great trouble. And I got into that area that a lot of people get into in AA, out there in that wilderness again, where AA really was a big myth, that I was not in communication with anybody, and these steps were not working for me because I knew the book chapter and verse, and it was all a big dream, and the pain was so great, and my fears were so great, and I was out in that wilderness, and I like to say that I had a power failure, and that's exactly the right place for me to be. I had a power failure, and God put me out there alone so I could find me at a truer depth. I went through the agonies that we go through. I don't know whether they call it a dry drunk down here or what they call it, but for me it was an absolute total wilderness again, and the futility and the frustrations and all these things came into full bloom, and all of my character defects that I thought God had plucked out of me had just been dormant, and they came into full bloom, and here I was, the great healer of the West Valley, ready to, you know, just hanging on that ragged edge. But thank God for these women and the women's stag and this new sponsor of mine, because she had more compassion and more patience and more everything than anyone that I had ever known, and probably the wisest woman I know today. I even went into what I at one time felt was enemy territory, Al-Anon. And so I also am a butterfly, girls. all these things are very valuable experiences to me. I wouldn't change one thing. I wouldn't change one thing. One moment of my life since I've been on Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I found out that I'm not big, brave, and strong. And I found out that I don't have to be. I found out so many things about my own selfishness, the dimensions of it. And I found out so many things about the emotional demands I put upon this man. Because, you see, that image that I had of him, no human could live up to. And this marriage is terminated, yet a miracle has happened. Because I don't have to look back in anger at anybody or anything anymore. Nor do I have to look to the future in fear. I now can look around in awareness. To me, the things that are important are the things I have in here, because no one can take them away from me. These things that the women of Alcoholics Anonymous have shown me. Because you see, I tried so desperately all my life to be a lady, and I never could make it. And really, I didn't know that it wasn't a lady that I wanted to be. I wanted to be a woman, a total woman, a total woman. And I'm learning. I'm learning slowly and painfully. That's how the program works. The things that are important to me today are the feelings I have inside. And you know, I can't verbalize all the things that I feel. And sometimes it's more profound not to be able to say them. Because we do have a communication that nobody else in the world has. For instance, I remember last year, my son made first ring varsity. That's fabulous. It's fabulous that I can think of it. And I remember sitting out there on that football field by myself at the end and watching these kids warm up. And I started thinking, where would he be if it weren't for Alcoholics Anonymous and the people? And I started to choke up. And the loudspeaker gave the list of the starting players, and it came to my son's name, and I started to choke up further because I knew that if it weren't for the people of Alcoholics Anonymous, they wouldn't have called his name and I wouldn't be sitting in those stands. Then when he downed the ball carrier, I broke down and cried. And my little daughter said to me, "Mother, why are you crying?" How can I tell her? You know, Alcoholics Anonymous isn't about Cadillacs, beautiful jobs, or any of those things to me. Alcoholics Anonymous, the program, really works when things go bad. That's when Alcoholics Anonymous works for me. When things go bad. Because so many things have happened to me since I've sobered up that would have been absolutely and totally impossible for me to face if I'd had but one drink. For instance, a few months ago, at 10 o'clock at night, the doorbell rang, and I answered it, and it was a juvenile officer asking for my 13-year-old daughter. She was 12 at the time. And I invited him in, and he went over to her and asked her name, and she identified herself. And he said the words that turned me cold. He said, "You're under arrest." It seems that she'd been involved with another teenage girl in Grand Theft Auto. And they took her away, and I stood there numb for a while. Later on, the other little girl's father and I went down to the police station. And I remember sitting in the hallway there for 2 hours while my daughter was being interrogated. And you know what I was thinking? I was thinking how precious my sobriety was. And I was thinking how very, very much I owed the people of Alcoholics Anonymous because I was sitting in that hallway sober with my head up and my eyes up. And I was thinking, God, please don't ever give me that kind of arrogance that lets me say, but I don't want that quality of sobriety, or his sobriety, or her sobriety isn't worth much. My God, I was so thankful just to be sober with a clean breath sitting there. To be there when she needed me the most, to be sitting there taking care of my responsibility as a mother. That's no small gift that the people of Alcoholics Anonymous gave me. Because, you see, the other little girl's mother had been a baby of mine and had gone back to that never-never land of pills and couldn't show up. And she eventually lost her daughter. They took her away from her. And she's right now in a recovery house. And, you know, it could have been the other way around, and I'm very aware of it. It could have been the other way around. Alcoholics Anonymous is about love and service. It's about you helping me and me helping you, and we in turn helping each other. And I talked about the wilderness before. I think that God wants us to learn to walk alone. And because he wants us to learn to walk alone, he sometimes has to let go of our hand. And as long as we're willing, he's even pleased with our stumbling. I think I can tie up the whole picture of AA by telling you of an incident that happened down in Laguna Beach, where Chuck comes from. A friend of mine called me and told me that he had a graphic picture to describe to me because he went on a 12-step call, and with him he took a man that had 30 days sobriety. And they called upon this man in rather a shabby, vacant apartment, vacant except for a mattress on the floor and one chair and wine bottles all over the floor. And when they arrived, the old man was sitting there in desperate need of help, and his hearing aid had fallen on the floor, and he was in terrible shape. And so Vic said, I think maybe we'd better take this man to my home, and let's give him a bath, and then we'll talk to him, which they did. And he said they talked to him at great length. And came time for Vic to go to bed, and he said he was closing the door, and as he looked over his shoulder, there he saw the whole picture of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said because the old man was lying in bed with his hearing aid turned up full blast. And the man with 30 days sobriety was on the side of the bed on his knees, reading chapter 3 to the alcoholic. And the old man was crying. The old man had come home. And so have I. And I can't tell you what it means to me to walk in the dignity of sobriety. And for this, I thank you from the bottom of my heart.